Fans, as we get ready for Giants baseball, it's a pleasure to bring Howard Bryant to the show. Of course, Howard, a good friend of ours, has been on the show many times. He's got a new book out. It's called Ricky, R-I-C-K-E-Y. That's all you have to know. The life and legend of an American original, and that, of course, is Ricky Henderson. Howard, it's great to have you with us here. Howard, of course, is the author of 9 previous books, including The Last Hero, a biography of the life of Henry Aaron, and The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. He's a senior writer for ESPN and the sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition. We see him all the time on TV. We hear him on the radio. Howard Bryant is one of the best in the country. Howard, it's great to have you with us.
Marty, always a pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I must say that, you know, I get a lot of books that come across, and we try to do one of these every weekend. And this one is one of the best, and it is about Ricky Henderson. But there's so many aspects of his life that you go into that, in my opinion, every Bay Area baseball fan should read it, and any baseball fan anywhere should understand the greatness of Ricky Henderson. Howard, tell us why this book for you. How did this come about?
Well, I think that the biggest reason I wanted to do this book was because it's been an amazing and very heartbreaking decade. When you think about where we've been in sports over the last 10 years, you start with Trayvon Martin and you go to Ferguson and Eric Garner and Colin Kaepernick and kneeling. And it's so tumultuous. It's been so tumultuous. And then, of course, when you're thinking about baseball, of course, you're coming out of the steroid era. You're looking at the Hall of Fame now. Of course, we saw the Hall of Fame ending the way it did this January without Roger Clemens, without Barry Bonds getting into the Hall. And then, of course, that doesn't even include biogenesis. And so I began to think, and of course, Alex Rodriguez. And so I began to think about that. I don't want to say that I was burning out, Marty, but I do want to say I was having trouble hearing myself. I was having trouble thinking that I was losing a little bit of the reasons why we love these athletes, the reasons why we stick around and why they do the things they do to us. And I wanted to have some fun. I was like, I need to go back to the roots of how I got into this and why this matters and to tell a story that incorporates a lot of the elements of the serious work that I do, but really gets me back to baseball. And I think Ricky picked off a lot of those boxes for me.
Oh, it's great, and they certainly do. And what I like about it, and we can go through certain parts of it, and we'll get to Ricky's final numbers a little bit later as we talk about it, because the final numbers are just amazing to me to just see them again. But you do a nice history of Oakland and the migration of the African-American community to Oakland in the late 40s, and, of course, Ricky growing up in Oakland. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think it was also the fact that I started my career in Oakland. 1991, I was at the old Tribune. I was one of the, if not the last person, the late, great Bob Maynard hired at the old building over on 12th and 13th Street. And I just felt like I just remembered covering preps and covering the OAL and Skyline and McClyman's and Fremont and Oakland Tech, of course, and the rest. And we always talk about the Great Migration in so many different ways. We talk about it the way that it shaped America's big cities, the way it shaped Chicago and Detroit and Philly and Boston and New York and the rest of it. But we never talk about how the Great Migration shaped sports. When we talk about the phenomenal athletic prowess of Oakland, you talk about Bill Russell and Frank Robinson. And, of course, having Frank Robinson and Veda Pinson and Curt Flood all in the same outfield at McClyman's. We always talk about it as a coincidence. What a crazy coincidence. It's not a coincidence. It's one of the legacies of the Great Migration. It was segregation. When all of those black people came from 1940 up until the early 60s, the mid-60s, really that first decade, black people were really only allowed to live in West Oakland. And so that's the reason why McClyman's was the school of champions, why you had all those great, great players in one spot. And so I wanted to dig back and trace those roots and to trace how those players got to Oakland, how their families got to Oakland. And you see that Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas essentially shaped the Great Migration in Oakland. And I believe at one point in the late 1940s, 65% or almost 70% of the black population in Oakland was from Texas or Louisiana. And that includes Dave Stewart's family. That includes Bill Russell's family. That includes Bip Roberts' family. And then, of course, when you add Arkansas into it, Lloyd Mosby and Ricky and Paul Silas. And it's just an unbelievable history. And I didn't even know that Paul Silas, the great Paul Silas, the great Boston Celtic, that he is first cousins with the Pointer Sisters. And they all lived in a house over on Adeline, around the corner from McClyman's. And that you look at Monroe, Louisiana, where Bill Russell was from. Huey Newton, founder of the Black Panthers, was also from Monroe. And it turns out they live a few blocks from each other over in Acorn, out in West Oakland. And so, to me, it was just such a rich history. At some point, I was thinking, okay, I got to get back to Ricky because I love this history. I could have written an entire book on that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a great beginning to the book. And I always say you have to know where someone comes from and the early parts of their lives is to learn who they are as an adult. But Ricky as a kid was interesting, and I learned so much in reading this part about Ricky's athletic ability as a kid, football versus baseball, and he was amazing as a kid. I didn't realize how dominant he was as a young man.
Yeah, he was the football kid. That was his nickname. That's what all the baseball guys called him. In fact, the baseball guys, the big kids there playing, Dave Stewart, Mosby, Gary Pettis, those guys, they knew Ricky could play, but they saw him as a football player. They remember watching Ricky walk around carrying a football all the time, and that's why they called him the football kid. And I'm not going to say that they didn't think Ricky was a formidable baseball player, but they didn't think that was his pathway. They didn't think that was his destiny. And then, as it so turns out, Ricky gets on the ball field and just absolutely dominates there as well once he begins to realize that he can do this as well. And I think talking to his wife, Pamela, she was fantastic on this subject, where she had just said there was never anything that he put his mind to athletically that he couldn't do, that he could just sort of bend the sport to his will. And it really was fascinating listening to people talk about a 10, 12, 14-year-old like that.
You know, it's amazing to me is finding out about the school counselor who got him to play baseball by offering him a little bit of an incentive to do it. It's an amazing part of the story.
Yeah, his guidance counselor in the eighth grade, Tommy Wilkinson, just wanted him to play. They were short players for, I believe, one of the Easter tournaments. And Ricky didn't want to play. Ricky was a football kid. And so she offered him a quarter for every stolen base and I think a dime for a run scored. And Ricky walked out of there. He was making $5 a week. He's like, I got to eat better than I ever ate at that time. And so that's how he also realized that he had dominant athletic ability. It was great talking to Ricky about this as well, because we know that these players are different. We know they are in the different stratosphere in terms of what they can do. But when you ask Ricky, when did you know that you had world-class ability? He would tell you he was 11 or 12 years old. And to me, that's also part of that legend of Oakland, where for that neighborhood, for those communities, because they saw so many of their guys make it, they didn't have a lot of stardust when it came to looking at their guys make it. The rest of us can see no pathway to the NBA or the NFL. But if you're an Oakland kid, you see Joe Morgan, you see Frank Robinson, you saw Rudy May and Veda Pinson and the rest of them, you see Kurt Flood. They're one of you. And so if they can do it, why can't you? And that's pretty much how Ricky saw it.
Well, but Ricky, you know, when you look at the numbers, of course, the 2,000 runs, 2,000 walks, 3,000 hits, the stolen bases, 1,400 or more, and you say, well, he must have been a first-round pick. He probably was the first guy taken in the draft, but that didn't happen. And Mr. James Gwynn was a big part of it. I've met him. He's a wonderful man, his son Brian as well. Mr. Gwynn saw something in Ricky, but even with that, he was not a top pick in the draft.
No, one of my favorite things, Marty, about doing this book was the generosity of Oakland, how absolutely tremendous people were. Talking to Shooty Babbitt from Berkeley, and Shooty connected me with Mr. Gwynn, and Dave Stewart, when you start talking to these guys and you want to tell their story, and that they trusted you with the story, even though I'm not from Oakland, I just started my career there. They made this book happen. And sitting down with Mr. Gwynn and hearing all of the stories about, you know, Charlie Finley has, he signs, you know, Mr. Gwynn as one of his scouts. You know, he didn't even receive a bonus for his two greatest finds, Clyde Washington first and then Ricky Henderson. And the reason why Finley didn't give him any money for it was because he said, oh, you'll never do that again. So it was really something listening to Mr. Gwynn talk about it. And he's part of the migration, comes from Jefferson, Texas. And so all of these guys, so much of it was autobiographical. It's not just Ricky's book. It's also their book. It's their story. And I wanted to make sure that they had a chance to talk about their arc, because it really is a remarkable community. Oakland gets such a bad rap all the time, but boy, when you get over there and you get to be a part of it for even a little while, you can feel how special it is.
Well, wonderful. The book is called Ricky, and that's all you need to know. Howard Bryant is with us, the life and legend of an American original. Well, he gets into baseball, and we'll talk a little bit more as we go through this, his reputation. But he goes to the minor leagues like so many kids for the first time, and it's really chronicled very well in the book, his experience in the minor leagues and getting called up to the major leagues.
Well, I think the thing that Ricky, whenever I do a book, Marty, especially, I've done two biographies now, and I'm learning how to do them. And when I, you know, when I did The Last Hero, the Henry Aaron bio, I always started to think about, I look at these subjects as locomotives, and you've got this gigantic coal engine, and you're shoveling coal into the engine that makes the train go. And you're asking yourself, what is that coal made of? And as you begin to try to answer that question, that's your book. What is the coal made of? What is the coal that made Ricky Henderson move? What was it? And so much of it was respect, and respect through money. And it's a money story in a lot of ways. And when Ricky gets drafted, Ricky was expecting $100,000. That's how good he believed he was. He got $10,000. And he saw that as a complete slight. He gets to the minor leagues and he tears the minor leagues apart, and yet doesn't get called up when he wants to get called up. He nearly quits in Double A in Jersey City in 1978 because he can't get along with the manager, John Kennedy. And he's about to quit and go to college and go to Arizona State and play football after all. And he sticks with it, but doesn't get called up as quickly as he wants to. And so there's a thing about Ricky where his drive to succeed is enormous. And the reason why I find that, why I'm pointing this out, because obviously no professional athlete is lacking in drive to be great, but it ran so counter to the common narrative that Ricky somehow didn't want to play, or that Ricky didn't fight through injuries, or Ricky wasn't committed to winning. Ricky is all about competition. I remember talking to Lloyd Mosby, who was fantastic on the subject, where he said, it didn't matter if we were playing ping pong, dominoes, basketball, football, Rick had to win. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a theme that goes throughout the entire book, this idea that there are other things on Ricky's mind beyond winning. It was actually both. It was money and it was winning, because he believed himself to be a championship level player.
Yeah, I love the stories about Ricky. Number one, of course, in the book, he talks, if that's the way he actually talked, he talks in the third person. Ricky does this, Ricky does that, which we remember during his time with the A's, that would be reported from here and there. But the best part on the money issue was they said, you know, he was kind of tight with money. And the only time he ever let go of a check was to put it in the other hand. I like that. I love that phrase.
Oh, that was the A's trainer, Bobby Aleo. And he said, yeah, he said the only time Ricky let go of a dollar was to get a better grip.
I love it.
It's a classic line. And I, you know, and that's one of the things when you talk about what is that coal made of, you know, talking to Sandy Alderson about this, and Sandy and Ricky had titanic battles over arbitration about how much Ricky wanted to get paid and how much Sandy thought Ricky was worth. And how back then home run hitters, I mean, if you weren't a home run hitter, you didn't get the big money, and how personal Ricky took it. And one of the one of the great people who really helped out with this book in terms of his recollections was Mike Norris, the old 20-game winner. And Mike talked about how deeply personal arbitration was to Ricky, that this was a referendum on how the organization viewed him. They don't think I'm a good player. And Roy Eisenhart was fantastic on this. He says, no, what it really is that it's a flawed process. And you have one side picks, you know, a number and the other side picks another number. And you're essentially trying to work on what he referred to. You're attacking the flawed 5% of these superstar players. And Mike Norris was so great on this. Mike said, I didn't take it personally. Ricky took it personally. To me, I saw arbitration this way. I was either going to wake up rich or richer.
I love Mike Norris. We've had him on the show, and I've talked with him numerous times. Wonderful man. Great pitcher, and just had a lot of issues later on in life. But there is a connection with Ricky and Billy Martin, and Billy Martin and Ricky, I guess, get along really well in Oakland, and that gets Ricky's career going.
That sure does. And in fact, for all of the talk about Ricky, so many of us in media over the years had been focusing on Ricky as a character and Ricky's personality and whether Ricky did this or how Ricky did that. Focus so much more on how he was doing his thing as opposed to what he was doing, except Billy. Billy was the one who saw what Ricky could be. Billy was the one who allowed Ricky to be himself, and that's why Ricky put on his best performances for Billy. And it's how Ricky got to the Yankees. People think it was George Steinbrenner and greedy George Steinbrenner wanting the biggest baubles in the free agent or in the trade marketplace. George didn't want Ricky. It was Billy Martin who told Ricky over and over when he was with the A's, if you really want to be everything you want to be in the game, if you want to be a superstar, legendary, never to be forgotten player, you have to do it in pinstripes. And it was Billy that really got George to make that deal. And it's interesting when you think about Ricky as a Yankee. He put up huge numbers with the Yankees and yet got a reputation as being the malingerer. 1985, Ricky scores 146 runs in 143 games. And you had this unbelievable team that won more games than anybody else in the 80s, but they never made the playoffs in the Ricky Winfield, Mattingly, Willie Randolph, Don Baylor years. And so now you get the trade back to Oakland in June of 89, and Ricky is stuck with this label. Here's a guy who compiles. Here's a guy who puts up big numbers, but he's not a winner. And anybody in the Bay, on either side of the Bay, knows that Ricky in 1989 is one of the great, great offensive performances we've ever seen in that sport. And it was all fueled by one thing, by Ricky trying to prove that he was not only a guy who put up big numbers, but he was a championship-level ball player. And boy, did we see that in the 89 ALCS and then in the World Series against the Giants.
Fabulous. I love this part of the book. And Sandy Alderson was pretty good in these conversations as well.
He was fantastic. Ricky, and Marty, I was going to say one other thing very quickly, is that there's the great might have been, which is during the 89 summer when Ricky has fallen apart with the Yankees. There's a deal on the table between the Giants and the Yankees to bring Ricky to the San Francisco Giants. And the deal falls apart because Ricky vetoed the trade. Because Ricky wanted to bat leadoff, and supposedly the Giants were very happy with Brett Butler and wanted Ricky to hit fifth. He doesn't hit fifth. Sandy steps in, makes the deal to get Ricky, and then Ricky faces the Giants 3 months later in the World Series.
Well, yeah, I was just going to bring that up. That was my next question to you. And Scott Gorelts is in that deal as well. And the Yankees loved it, but Ricky. As Ricky says, Ricky doesn't play in the National League, and Ricky ain't going. That's what he said. Well, he got traded a number of times, which you've talked about, underappreciated. But his reputation among his peers, was it selfish, cocky? What was his reputation? I know they were in awe of him on the baseball field, all the things he could do. But did they want to be teammates with him?
Well, Ricky was aloof. Ricky was a little distant. I remember talking to Dennis Eckersley about it, and Eck said that Ricky was always sort of off to himself doing his own thing. But when Ricky wanted to really put his nose in it as a competitor, you couldn't beat him. You couldn't get him off the plate. He took both sides of the plate whenever he wanted. He stole whatever base he wanted. And it is interesting to me because there are times when people would talk about Ricky's attitude and Ricky fighting over money and Ricky fighting over contract and status against Canseco, et cetera, and his battles with Tony La Russa, all the above. But the one thing about Ricky that was very clear at the end of the day was he obliterated the record book. He absolutely destroyed the record book. And you can say what you want about how he handled himself during those years. I argued with my friend Bob Ryan when he said, boy, it would just be amazing. How good would Ricky have been? And I completely took umbrage to that. I said, how good would he be? How much better could he have been? The issue wasn't, maybe he would have played for fewer teams, and maybe he wouldn't have had such contention in his career had he been of a different personality. But better? How much better can you be than 3,000 hits, 2,000 runs, 2,000 walks, and 1,400 stolen bases?
Yeah, I love it. It's all in the book, all these stories, and we're just sort of touching on a few of them. It's all in there. Not only the details of Ricky's career with the teams, but there's a love of baseball that comes across in your writing. The romance of the game with the game, the heart of the game comes across. And I think that's, for me, my favorite part of the book is I felt I was within the game. I was within the picture of reading this book. Howard, favorite
story?
Well,
it was really personal, Marty. I was just going to say it's really personal because – once again, you and I met in 1998. 1998 was the first year I was a full-time beat writer covering the A's for the San Jose Mercury News, which also happened to be Ricky's last year in Oakland, Ricky's last stint in Oakland. So much of the strains in this book are not just research-based, but they're also personal. You're going back and thinking about all these people, Jason Giambi when he was first becoming a player, Miguel Tejada's rookie year, Eric Chavez's rookie year, you know, Barry Zito coming in later that year and Tim Hudson the next year. And all of that was part of the growth of my own personal growth coming in as a young reporter, coming from the Oakland Tribune to the Mercury News. And all of it sort of comes together here. And Ricky embodies all of it.
Well, there's some beautiful parts. Ricky's Hall of Fame speech, which the great Earl Robinson helped him with. And I got to meet Earl Robinson, and he's been on our show. There's just so many parts of the book that are fun and really give you the insight into Ricky Henderson. Do you have a favorite story? I know you get asked that a lot. And there's so many stories in the book, Howard, let me tell you. And I say that to all the listeners. You're going to love the baseball stories about Ricky, whether they're true or not. Do you have a favorite one?
Well, I think my favorite Ricky story is really the original Ricky story, which is when he's in high school as a 10th grader, he gets sent to the junior varsity.
Right.
And everyone is, you know, yelling at the brand new coach, Bob Cryer, who didn't know anything about baseball, but he just pointed at Ricky because he was one of the shorter kids and said, go to the junior varsity. And Ricky, as a 15-year-old, looks at the baseball coach, who's a grown man, looks at the coach and says, "You must not know who I am." and that tells you everything you need to know about Ricky's confidence and his belief in what he could do on a diamond. And boy, did he back it up.
Yeah, he did. And breaking the Cobb record, the Brock record, and everything else. We remember all that. It's all in the book. It's real, Howard. It's real. I think it's your best. I really do. And I've read them all. And I think this one is your best. There's a real love and for baseball and a love for Ricky that comes across in this book, and you get to hear all about it, his 22-year career. I just think it's terrific. The head first slide, how that came about, the snatch catch, how that came about.
Favorite piece of that is the snatch catch, which I didn't believe Ricky when he told me. I had to look it up and then find the video on YouTube that Ricky's very first snap catch was the final out of Mike Warren's no-hitter in 1983 at the Coliseum.
I love it. And Dave Henderson used to say, I think for one of the no-hitters, maybe it was Stu's no-hitter, Ricky tried to get the catch in front of him, and I think Hendu caught it instead, and he always told that story as well.
Great stuff. I loved it.
Yeah, it is. It's great stuff. It really is, and there's just so many parts of it. But that beginning of learning about Oakland and what he did as a kid and how dramatic he was as an athlete, as a young man, And thank God for Mr. Gwynn and the faith that he had in him. Howard, the book is great. I know you've gotten a lot of accolades on it. Of course, we get it at all the outlets, and I got mine, of course, at the Book Tree in Montclair. David has all the good baseball books up there. So congratulations on it. I think it's your best, and I love having you on and getting to meet you in 1998. My show may have been your first experience on radio. I don't know. Yeah, had everybody on way back in 98. That was my first year of right off the bat. So you and I have a long history, too, so I appreciate it. I really do.
No, thank you, Marty. It's always fun. It's always great. Every time I have a book, you've been there, so I do appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Ricky is the name of it, R-I-C-K-E-Y. That's all you have to know. All right, more coming up. KNBR 680-1045, the sports leader.